So, Jeremiah chapters 9 and 10. I'm mindful here through these really chapters 8, 9, and 10 about this great weeping prophet of Jeremiah. And Mike brought this up last week, how Jesus was also, in a sense, a weeping prophet. Jesus wept over Jerusalem. Jesus wept when one of his best friends had died, Lazarus. Mike read, and I'd just like to read it again because it's so powerful, is Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19. And this is where Jesus has ridden into Jerusalem on a donkey. And as he's approaching Jerusalem in verse 41, he saw the city and he wept over this great city. And this is the same city that we're talking about in our study in Jeremiah. And this is what Jesus had to say as he's looking upon the landscape of Jerusalem. If you had known in this day, Luke 19, verse 42, if you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. And we're reading essentially the same message in Jeremiah. This is what Jeremiah is weeping over. This is what Jeremiah is trying to get the Judahites to understand, is this day of visitation is coming. Just turn and repent and live. And he's weeping over this great city. Now again, like a lot of the what we call major prophets, where there's a lot of information, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 chapters, there's a lot of repetition. And so we've heard this message before in the book. First of all, Israel has rejected God. They have broken the covenant. They've refused God's repentance. And as a result of that, they're going to face judgment in the form of an invading army from the north, which is going to be who? It's going to be Babylon. In the first century, who was the invading army? In the first century. Rome. Yeah, right. And so also, just like the Jews in the first century A.D., this disaster can't be averted. Their hearts are just seared. There is no repentance, and any kind of, you know, ritual or elaborate ritual or hiding in the temple for safety, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. But the core message here in chapters 8, 9, and 10, I think, is nuanced in two ways. First of all, Jeremiah, he gives us some insight into the perversity of sin. And he explains that to us. And how idolatry, in particular, we're going to look at in chapter 10, is just so destructive. These people would sink all their hopes and all their faith in these idols, and ultimately, when it came time to deliver, the idols fail. And so that leaves the people, you know, hopeless, and the idols actually just drag them down. They cause these people to suffer. But we also see, as we've been seeing before, the grief in the words of the prophet. And as we've noticed, as you've been noticing as you read through, you know, who exactly is talking sometimes is hard to discern. But one commentator said, it is best sometimes not to decide, for the voice of one expresses the heart of the other. The tears of one are the tears of the other. And so we shouldn't really get hung up so much on that kind of thing. So in chapter 9, we're going to look at the breakdown in the heart of society, the death of this great culture here. What does God here long for, or Jeremiah, whoever is speaking there in verse 2? What does he long for in verse 2? A return to worshiping God. Okay, anybody else? David?
Return deserted place to hide from the people because they've been so wicked.
Okay, yeah. Both are true there. It's interesting that verses 1 of chapter 9 and verse 2 in chapter 9, they begin with this expression of longing, right? Whoever is speaking there is longing for something in verse 1, but he's also longing for something in verse 2, but they're completely different longings. What is he longing for in verse 1? Yeah. I wish I had enough tears to cry for you guys. That's how stricken with grief I am over Jerusalem. But the longing in verse 2 is coupled with what the fact Bill said. Yeah, I wish you guys would, you know, straighten up and serve me. But what he says in verse 2, literally, I wish I had a place really far away from you guys. Because being around you and being around this sinful attitude, this corrupt society, is just unbearable. And so he wants to remove himself from this wicked generation. And why is that? He gives us some reasons in verses 3 through 6. What were they? What kind of sins were they guilty of? And what does the prophet highlight here for us? Okay, deception, lies. Anything else? Okay, adulterous, verse 2. Treacherous men. You just deceptive people. Just have no honor, no regard for truth or the word of God or being honest. And so their tongues are these just instruments of death. There's no friendship. Look in verse 4. Let everyone be on guard against his neighbor. Even in my own people who are supposed to be this representation of me, of righteousness and holiness and compassion and love. You know, this is what Israel is supposed to be so that they could reflect God to the nations. Exodus chapter 19, verses 4 and 5. But yet, here they're just slandering each other, cheating each other. So God says, you know, don't even trust your neighbor because they'll sell you out. They'll backstab you, you know, they'll lie about you. Do not trust any brother. So no friendship, no kinship was sacred. Look at verse 5. Everyone deceives his neighbor, does not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. In other words, they've become these masters of deception. They have learned and invented new ways to tell lies and to be dishonest. And so they're masters of deception. Lying is like an art form. And their words in verse 3 and verse 8, they're arrows, they're weapons to fight against one another. Mo.
Their consciences are seared also.
Yeah. Yeah, we've noted this before that they don't know how to blush, right? They don't feel any pang in their conscience, as you say, to change. Yeah, Mike.
Verse 3 says they go from evil to evil. There is no end to what they will and have done. And he gives a reason because they don't know it.
Right.
There is no limitation. There is no guideline, boundary.
Exactly, and that point there, they don't know me, you know, they refuse to know me. That, I think, is at the heart of all of this. They refuse to know me. And God's been reaching out through the law, through Jeremiah, through his prophets over the years, for this very thing, to get them to know him. So in verse 2, I threw you a curveball. This is a tough question, and I don't expect, you know, there to be some sort of cut and dry answer there, but it was kind of a way to get you to think. Could God ever leave his people? Because in verse 2, he's expressing his wish to leave, isn't he? That might be a tough question. Janice is going to...
I always have felt that it's the people that leave him.
All right.
We leave him. He's always there for us. If he would have always been there for them, they've done, obeyed, and followed what's
good. Yeah, I think it's a great answer. Yeah. Is anyone else that want to add to that? Yes, Mo.
He's the father of the prodigal.
Right.
Always waiting.
Mm-hmm. He allows his people to leave. He gives them that choice. But he's always there. He's always there. His wish from Abraham on is I want to be your God. I want you to be my people. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. But the fact is, he allows his people a choice. And when they turn their backs on him and they begin to worship other gods, God will allow them to do that. And so in a sense, he's allowing them to leave. But, you know, the expression in verse 2 is, boy, I wish I could. I wish I could get out of here. Because you guys are just disgusting to me, the way that you're living your life. Yeah. And that is the promise, the promise that kept God from wiping out his people a number of times. Remember when Israel was just being so wicked in the book of Exodus and Moses has to intercede? And what does Moses tell God as he's praying to him to get him to relent?
Remember your promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Exactly. Remember your promise. What will the nations think? You know, remember your promise that you've promised never to leave. And so God, he does relent from disaster. Same thing in Deuteronomy and Exodus and on through those rebellious generations. But he is leaving this generation. This generation here, well, as Janice pointed out, has left him. And so they're going to certainly be judged. Let's move on then the next set of verses here, verses 7 through 11. So you have a breakdown in the heart of society, but you also have brokenness in the heart of God. Now, God has been put in a very difficult situation here. You could almost hear God, you know, trying to explain that to his people. And what position is that based upon these verses? All right. Yeah. Was it you, Nick, who pointed this out as a parent? You made me do this. I don't want to do this. But you see the position that you've put me in here. And I appreciate this in the prophets, where Jeremiah is giving us a window into the heart of God. And sometimes we don't know what's going through God's mind. But here we do. And we see that he's struggling with this. He doesn't want to do this at all. He's not happy to do this. And so he bounces this question, you know, back on his people. What else can I do? Should I not punish this wicked people? Yes, Richard. Good point. Right. This is all part of the law. Right. This is all part of the law. So God has already told them about this, that if they were going to behave this way, this is what's going to happen. If you remember the book of Deuteronomy, just that book is becoming more and more important as we study Jeremiah and the prophets. But yeah, he's warned them. You behave this way, this is going to be the consequences. And so if he doesn't punish them, then all of a sudden he's something that he promised not to be. And so he's unjust. He is not righteous, and he's not faithful to his word. But again, so in verse 11, he promises, I will make Jerusalem a heap of ruins, a haunt of jackals. I will make the cities of Judah a desolation without habitation. That's the conclusion God comes to. How's he feel about it in verse 10? Very, very sorrowful. And he's grieving. He's weeping for creation, for the mountains, for the land of Judah. So God is not delighting in this at all, certainly. But I think it's good that that God bounces that question back on Israel. You know, what would you guys do if you're in my situation? What would you do if a human being treated you like that? You know, what would your courts decide? All of a sudden, it's a lot easier to see things from God's perspective. Any questions or comments about that before we move on? Yes, Cindy.
I like how in verse 7, he actually gives the reason for it. He says, see, I will refine and test them. What else can I do? Because it's through that refining and that testing, because of their sin, that the desire is for them to be made better.
Right.
Just like it is with our our kids when we have to punish or let them dig the hole and crawl back out. It's for their good.
Right.
And hopefully it brings about a better behavior.
Right. Again, going back to Deuteronomy chapter 8, which is what the Hebrew writer talks about in chapter 12. I'm disciplining you as a son. And, if you love your children, that's exactly what you're going to do. You're going to do the hard thing. You're not just going to give them handouts. You're not just going to allow them to persist in disobedience. You're going to punish them. And again, the end game, as Cindy has pointed out, is to test them, not to tempt them, not to tempt them to do evil, but in hopes that they'll learn the lesson, in hopes that they'll become stronger and more faithful. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, Charles.
Good correction, instruction, and righteousness. The man of God may be thoroughly furnished, equipped in all good works.
Right. Appreciate it.
Do we ever think about that sometimes? Yeah. Or do we ever give credence to that?
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. When we're going through a struggle in life, is that how we look at it? You know, do we think, why me? Why do I have to go through this? Or do we, as James says, okay, you know, God is faithful. He loves me. I'm His son through faith in Jesus. This is going to be good for me. I'm going to be joyful through this experience because I know that God is assaying me. He's testing me. He wants to refine my faith. Yeah, easier said than done, for certain. Okay, then God gives His rationale for judgment. And if a wise man were to ask God why He punished Israel, what reason does God give? Verses 12 through 16.
Because they've forsaken my law, disobeyed my voice, been stubborn, turned to idolatry.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
All that stuff, yeah. It's kind of like an equation. If someone were to ask why, you know, God says, you've apostatized, you've broken my covenant, you know, you've turned your back on me, verse 13, then you've gone one step further and you've gone to worship other gods, verse 14. And that is going to lead to judgment, exile, and death, verses 15 and 16. So it's very, I don't want to belittle that, but it's like a, it's like an equation, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. You know, turn your back on me, you go to worship other gods, this is what's going to happen. And should they have been surprised about this? Yeah, they've been warned. They've been warned. Deuteronomy, again, is such an important book. As Israel is in the wilderness, very much the same attitude of rebellion. Then finally they're in the plains of Moab. And they're about ready to cross over into the promised land. And just before they do, Moses gives them a speech, if you remember. And the speech that Moses gives is the book of Deuteronomy. And it's saying, when you go in there, guys, this, you got to remember this, right? Don't forget who gave you this land. You know, wells that you didn't dig, homes that you didn't build, you know, gardens that you didn't plant, and all of this. And by the way, when you go after other gods, this is what's going to happen. Not if, you know, but he anticipates that his people are going to turn their back. How painful of a position is that? I mean, that is such a burden. If you knew and you had, I don't know what you call that, prescience or whatever, that you could see into the future, that your child was going to do X, Y, and Z against you, how hard would that be to take as a parent? That would be tough. Yeah. Mike.
Yeah. Three verses there, just look how many times they and their and them is mentioned. The blame was totally on Judah.
Yeah.
Not God that's done
it. Yeah. God has gone out of his way to do everything he could to make sure this didn't happen. Also, this might be kind of an aside. I appreciate the Bible translations that do, like, if it's poetry, they'll put it on the page a little bit differently. You know, they'll make it inset. Each line is inset like a poem. And then if it's prose, they'll make it like in paragraph form. My version does that. I have a couple versions that don't do that. I kind of appreciate that because What we've got here in verses 12 through 17 is prose. It's not poetry. And so when you've got a bunch of poetry, the prophet is well, why do the prophets use poetry? Let's open that up, a can of worms. Why poetry? What can you do in poetry that you can't do in prose? Why not just write it out in paragraph form? Any poetry fans in here? Okay, you can be. You can use metaphor. Makes you think. Anybody else?
Makes the point clearer to you, so it's easier to understand.
Yeah, it's less literal, isn't it? It's poetic. It's more illustrative. You can say things. It's like when you listen to music on the radio, right? You can say things with poetry that you could never say writing an essay or in conversation. And so it's very powerful, very visceral and descriptive in ways that you can't be with prose. And so that's why, you know, you have these massive sections of just judgment. And it's written in poetry. So God and his prophet can be you know, use this forceful, powerful, poetic language. And then all of a sudden you've got this prose. So what's that all about? What's the purpose of prose, or what's the benefit of prose above poetry? All right, yeah. This is when you're writing, some sort of legal document. You're not going to write it in poetry, right? You're going to want to spell everything out, you know, to a T. And so here we've got this little section. You want to know why you're in exile? Let me tell you exactly why. You know. You've broken my covenant. Line A. Line B. You've gone after idols. And that's why, verses 15 and 16, you're in the situation you're in. Yeah. David, I'm sorry. Do you have a comment, brother?
It was further back.
Sorry. We've lost. Okay. Yeah. It's lost its relevance. Sorry about that. All right. Moving on to verses 17 through 22. Verses 17 through 22. Did you guys do any research about these wailing women? Wailing women. God is calling for these wailing women. Who are these people? What? I get a sense of what they do, but why?
Well, I think they were like professional mourners, people that would come to help mourn, you know, a death.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't part of the family.
Yeah.
But that's what they did.
Which is. It's a little bit strange to me. I don't know. That Richard. Yeah, it's very much a cultural thing, right? And this was true in the days of Jesus, right? You had professional mourners. These were grief professionals. They would when a tragedy was upon them. They would hire these people, they'd pay them, and they were skilled in singing songs of lament. And those songs were meant to stir up within you grief and sorrow so that you could cry and you could wail with them and you could, you know, honor the dead, you know, or comfort the bereaved through your tears. And so God says, you call these people. Yeah, all of these professional mourners, their time has come, because you're going to need these ladies when Jerusalem's going to be besieged. Right. It's interesting. Verse 1 starts with maybe the prophet crying. Verse 10, you've got God weeping and the very creation weeping. And now, in verse 17 through 22, he's calling the entire nation of Israel to mourn and cry. Charles.
I would think about it. After all that's gone, the Israelites put God through because of their sins and unrighteousness. They would understand the purpose for which the crime was about. Mm-hmm. That in the midst of them, there were people who were actually seeing these things come about and take place, and they knew what was going on.
Yeah. What's the significance there in verse 20 of them having to teach their daughters? How'd you like that, Mom? Teach your daughter how to mourn, how to sing a dirge. What do you guys think, Rodney?
Because the suffering's going to last beyond the mother's life.
Yeah. See, poetry can say things that are very clear, just in a metaphoric way. Yeah. That this suffering isn't going to end just with this generation. And so you're not going to be teaching your kids little nursery rhymes. You're not going to be teaching your kids, you know, little happy songs. You're going to teach them how to wail and how to mourn. It's really, I mean, it's just incredibly sad to be living in this time, because the, you know, your city is going to be besieged. You're going to be trapped, and there's not going to be anything to eat, and you can't get out. This is going to be violent, and when you're at your weakest, that's when they're going to be erecting these siege ramps, and Nebuchadnezzar's army is going to march in there. Everyone's going to be gone. David.
I think that also indicates how, you know, the people didn't really see this coming. They were too busy having a good time,
right,
you know, worshiping these idols, doing what they wanted to do.
Right.
And I think that's also part of this, having to teach your daughters to mourn.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. They have the wrong attitude. They ought to be weeping and mourning now. James 5 and verse 1, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, your garments have become moth-eaten, your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. So it could be the same thing in our generation as well. If we're thinking everything is happy days and, you know, we're rich and everything is just great, we've got to be careful and gain some perspective and say, what's really going on? You know, is God saying peace, peace right now, or is that just the false prophets? Mo.
That phrase, which would you rather listen to?
Yeah.
Things are great. Don't listen to this guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what he's talking about. Look at us.
Yeah.
We've got everything. Look at our nation now. We're green. We're growing. We've got everything. We're the most powerful.
Your young men, your army is going to fail. The corpses of men will fall like dung on the open field, like the sheaf after the reaper, but no one will gather them. Jesus is saying the same thing in his generation, right? You guys are so smart, you can look up in the sky and you can see how, you know, what the weather's going to be like, but you can't discern the signs of the times. You can't see that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed because you've turned your backs on God and because your hearts are corrupt. Yes, Richard and then Lance. You wonder, you know, what's going on in God's mind in heaven, you know. I'd be pretty angry if that were me. Of course, you know, we can't really put ourselves in God's shoes, but you just wonder how much he can take. Now, his patience is immense. The fact that he allows us to continue is great. Lance.
About death.
Yeah.
Paintings of that.
so much about the surroundings. Instead of focusing on the Lord, they've allowed themselves to be influenced by those things that are surrounding them, including wealth.
Yeah.
And relying on that, the same thing is going to happen. They're now going to be influenced by death.
Yeah.
And by the tragedy that is going to surround.
The tone of the nation is going to change. The songs of the nation are going to change. Absolutely. Good point. Good point. A lot of parallels to our culture, because we kind of have the same kind of problems that Judah was having, I think, in terms of, you know, just the love of money and lying. Goodness, the media. I mean, where is the truth? I have to dig and dig and dig for it, and sometimes I don't know if I have it. What actually happened in the story? It's not, you can't just read a story anymore and just assume that this is honest journalism. You've got to cross-reference it with like 17 other news sources with different agendas. And nobody's, I'm just being pessimistic, but it just seems like from my point of view, sitting on my computer, clicking and trying to find the truth, does anybody really care what actually happened? Or does everyone have some sort of agenda here they're trying to, yeah, we'll get to that at the end. But that's tough. That's the world we live in. Okay, verses 23 and 24, they are given this crucial choice here. Where are we? Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a question. How is death personified in verse 21?
Knocking at the door.
All right, knocking at the door. What else? Coming through the window, he's like a thief. He's like a grim reaper, exactly. He's like a thief crawling through the window, and he's got his sickle in his hand, except he's not going to be cutting down wheat. He's going to be slaughtering the people in Jerusalem. It's a grisly picture there in verses 21 and 22. Yeah. And so Israel has been boasting in several things. What three things was Judah boasting in? Just as they were corrupt from top to bottom. Remember, he said, can I find an honest person? Well, no, you know, among the rabble, you know, so the common people, there's no honesty. But surely the kings and the priests and the prophets, they'll be honest. Oh, no, they're not honest either. So as they're corrupt from top to bottom, there's going to be a top to bottom judgment as well. Yeah, good point, Mike. So what three things had Judah been boasting in here? Three things that aren't necessarily bad in themselves, but that can become bad when you boast in them and trust in them. Okay, riches, one of them. Wisdom and strength. So wisdom, strength, and riches. Now, those three things are not bad, but what happens, let's just take them one by one. What happens, let's say you're a very wise individual. You're very learned, you're very scholarly, you understand the Bible, which is great. But what happens when you begin to boast in that? What does that turn into? What does your wisdom turn into? Yeah, arrogance. And so you've defeated your purpose. Strength is good. Military strength is good. Right? It's good to have a strong army. But what happens when you boast in that, when you take pride in that, and when that becomes, you know, your source of trust. Yeah, you're indestructible. And I'm going to use that strength, right? And there's going to be violence. I'm going to beat down my oppressors with that strength. So you lose your meekness. What happens with your riches? Not wrong to be wealthy, but when you begin to boast in it and trust in it, what do your riches become?
Worthless.
Sorry? Yeah, they become worthless. And how were these people gaining their riches in the first place?
Deceitfully.
Yeah. Yeah, taking advantage of poor people is what they were doing in order to get rich. So these are the things that they were glorying in. They were trusting in. They were taking pride. They were boasting in these things. And so Jeremiah has actually already exposed their wisdom. They're a bunch of frauds. Chapters 8, verses 8 and 9. How can you say we are wise? The law of the Lord is with us. Behold, the lying pen of the scribes has made it into a lie. The wise men are put to shame. They are dismayed. They are caught. Behold, they have rejected the word of the Lord. What kind of wisdom do they have? It's an earthly, demonic wisdom that James talks about. And so they've been pointed out as frauds. The might, the strength of Judah's military, not going to be able to defend their fortified cities. Chapter 8 and verse 14. And we looked at their young men there in verse 21. The young men that are part of the military, they're going to be slaughtered as well. They won't be able to protect Judah. And their riches that were gained through dishonesty, they're going to become unprofitable. Yeah. What should they have been boasting in instead of these three things that we value and that we place a lot of importance on as human beings? What should they have been boasting in?
In God.
Okay, in God, the wisdom of God.
Understanding and knowing God.
All right.
Having a relationship.
Essentially, know who I am. And who is God, by the way? What's the description that he gives?
Love, justice, and righteousness.
Okay. Love, justice, and righteousness, or kindness, justice, and righteousness. In other words, these are the things you need to be concerned with. These are the character attributes that you need to be displaying in your life. And if you're going to count on any wisdom, count on my wisdom, godly wisdom. If you're going to count on any strength, count on my strength over the nations and over creation and over you. If you're going to count, you know, boast in riches, boast in the riches of the Lord, of knowing God. And so, but you boil it down, and it's what David said, just knowing God. Is that any different for us today? What does Paul say we should be boasting in?
The cross.
The what Jesus has done for us. This wonderful love. The love, the justice, and the righteousness of God is found in the cross. I think in this context we can understand the righteousness of God. And the justice of God, right? Because God he's punishing sin. He's just. You know, he's bringing a just punishment on Judah. He's righteous. He's keeping his promise that he made to his people. But what about kindness? What about love? How do we find the kindness of God? How do we find the love of God in this context of judgment? Can we? It seems to be out of place. But yet he says, this is who I am, and it's in keeping with everything I'm doing here. My kindness, my love.
I'm going to butcher the verse, but the paraphrase is, over in Hebrews, when God says, you know, the father who loves his son disciplines him.
Okay.
And so, back to the parent thing again.
Yeah.
As hard as it is, and as much as you don't want to do it because you love them, because you want to help them, you want to teach them, you want to help them grow. That's what he has to do because he loves them and he wants to see them change.
Yeah. So on our level, you know, with 2 feet on the ground down here, it looks nasty. You know, the discipline of God looks harsh. But from an eternal perspective, this is our Father. And he's disciplining us for our benefit, for our good. And so his punishment is just, it is righteous, but it is also loving. Richard. Boast in him, everything he is, his patience with us, what he's done for us in Jesus. Paul, from a human perspective, before he was a Christian, he had a lot to boast about. You know, he sat at the feet of Gamaliel, Pharisee of Pharisees, just ascending that ladder of Judaism. He was just on a one-way track to be the head honcho. And yet, he gives it all up for Jesus. And he says, far be it from me to boast in anything other than the cross. No.
They were going to have everything taken away from them. Think about if we have one blessing that we have. Take away electricity. Mm-hmm. Write down all the things that would be changed if we had no power. Oh my.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be going out to eat today.
Mm-hmm.
sweltering in this in the dark.
Mm-hmm. How trivial does that sound compared to this?
Or pure water.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet there are folks that they don't have that. I drink that every day. I wash my car with that stuff. We're rich. We're very rich. So let's be really careful that we boast in the Lord and in what He's done for us. And we use the good things. Use your wealth, you know, your riches, your strength, and your wisdom. Use those to glorify God, and don't boast in those things. Moving on very quickly. This, I think, bleeds in to the next little section very well. Israel among the nations. How could Israel be both circumcised and uncircumcised? That didn't seem to make any sense.
Well, they were physically circumcised, but spiritually they weren't.
Yeah. What's the list that he gives there? He gives a list of nations. He just sticks Judah right in the middle of these people, you know? What's interesting about this list of nations, really quick, is Egypt and Edom and Ammon and Moab, they actually all had rites of circumcision. I mean, they weren't doing it for the same reasons Israel was. But he says, your circumcision is just like theirs. It doesn't mean anything. Because you're acting just like them. Yeah. We'll pick up there, and thank you so much, brethren, for your comments. It's been a good class. Thank you.